Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Bijou Banter in the KRUI studio. We are here with a special guest returning in the KRUI studio, Kat Trout.
Hey, what's up?
And later on, we're going to have another special guest, Davey Beam, joining us. He will be here hopefully very shortly. And it is a very rainy Friday, November 4th of 2022. And today we are going to be talking about two films that have been recently released, the first being Tar, which is currently playing at Film Scene at the Chauncey in downtown Iowa City, as well as the Netflix stop-motion horror comedy, Wendell and Wild. And we are going to begin with Tar, which is written and directed by Todd Field. This was his first film in well over 15 years. And it stars Cate Blanchett, Noémie Merlant, and Nina Hoss. And the plot of Tar from IMDb, it's set in the international world of Western classical music and centers on Lydia Tar, who is widely considered one of the greatest living composer and conductors and the first ever female music director of a major German orchestra. What did you think about this film?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think it's been something I've been sitting on for a bit because, like, watching it, it just felt kind of overwhelming in the moment in a good way. And I've been thinking a lot about, like, the response to it online, which people have been kind of asking if she's a real person or not. And I think that that's what I took away from the movie is the masterfulness of which he creates character. Because, like, her being real and not being real, it doesn't really matter. It's the fact that, like, because she feels so human, and like all these controversies and these like passions she has are so tangible and kind of like in a kind of uncomfortable way, like relatable in a sense. I think she's just a very fascinating character, and Cate Blanchett was fantastic. So I think it's definitely a film that I'm going to continue to watch and rewatch. A part of me wishes it went more surreal because there are moments where it kind of reached into this like dream landscape, and I feel like it only scratched the surface with that, as well as with the music scenes, because like hearing that like overwhelming sound was just so beautiful. So yeah, I mean, overall though, I'm very excited to talk about it, very excited to discuss it. Yeah.
Yeah. Tar was a very, very interesting movie, and I haven't seen a film from Todd Field up until this point. He's only made three other films, the other ones being In the Bedroom and Little Children, I believe. So, and he really hasn't done anything since Little Children, which came out in 2006. So he's had a long hiatus, and everyone was saying like this is his triumphant return to making really great films. And until I see some of his other films, I cannot comment upon that. But I really, really loved this one. I thought this was a very, very interesting, very moving, and also very distressing film too. What makes it so fascinating is that Tar is not a real person.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, kind of like we were saying, there's a little bit of kind of discourse. I struggle to call it discourse just because if we do talk about more of the quote-unquote controversies or like disagreements people have, I find it a little silly, mm-hmm. I'll be honest. But it seems so grounded in our reality that it does, a lot of people were arguing like, oh yeah, this is basically what happens behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. And regardless of whether or not it's like music or film or just art in general, this could happen pretty much anywhere. And it never once feels like it's trying to be something greater than it is. I think what helps is that it doesn't feel full of itself.
Yeah.
And instead presents a really good character piece of someone who is pretty much a sociopath.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
There's no other way to put it. Tar is not a very, she's definitely a very flawed character, but at the same time, there's always this part of you that whether or not you agree with what she does throughout the entire film, you always seem to admire her ambition and just the height of her power, essentially, is just like, how would you react if you were faced with these situations, because the whole film is essentially about her dealing with these allegations and accusations about a past student that she was mentoring.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Speaking of like the part where you said like you kind of have a relation to her in a way with her passion, there was a part of it like near the end, which I won't give any spoilers, but when she's watching a concert of a composer she admires, I actually found myself like tearing up, and mm-hmm. I felt really weird tearing up because I was like, I know she's not a good person, and I do not like agree or condone anything she has done. But I think because as artists, we see that passion and we relate to that passion. And I think in a way it makes you uncomfortable with it. And that's a good thing because it's asking you how far can we go to the point where we don't even recognize that passion anymore? You know, and like what happens when we become too big that we forget the little people? I think that's why they played the credits backwards, because it starts with like the caterers, and it starts with like the smaller people on the set, and goes up to like the director. So I think it really questions like us as individuals and like the love that we have, but also how quickly that love can turn into something terrible.
And also how one moment in our in this person's career or in this lives literally changes their direction of their entire career, their reputation, and how Lydia Tár is essentially being looked up upon as like this new figure, and it's like, how are people going to look at her based on what has happened throughout this I don't even know what the time span is really of this whole movie, within, let's say it's a couple of months, within the past months, how basically everything's going down and how it's unknown if she can recover or not. How are people going to look at her? Are they going to revere her as like this great artist who was like so, has done so many things in her career that are like very admirable, or are people just going to focus on the negatives? Like, how do we want to approach that? And that's really fascinating just because that happens so much, especially in the last 5 years, like in just the industry.
Yeah, and I guess that goes into the conversation she has in the Juilliard sequence in that film. There's a scene where she's debating with a student about the legacy of Bach and like the like issues of Bach. And I think that I was actually speaking with this with my girlfriend, and she was talking about how, and I think this happened to us too, that like an older audience during that scene would laugh because they were like kind of laughing at the student who was like saying that he was BIPOC. Mm-hmm. And then we were kind of cringing because we knew what she was about to say because she was approaching him with this kind of like sneer, condescending attitude. And I think that goes into the tension with what you're talking about, which is like, I guess like the idea of like identity or like experience with artists and what happens to them and what the line is for like continuing to admire them or kind of like stepping away from them and like what their accomplishments mean in that like regard. It's a really like tricky like scope, you know what I mean?
It's a challenging movie. It challenges you with its themes and not really in what it shows. Cause there's many movies that show like really graphic, disturbing imagery. It's like, oh, this is challenging how you perceive like your morals and all that. But this is more subtle just because it's in the character actions. And there's really, despite this movie's over 2.5 hours, there's not really, it's super slow burn. The locations are pretty limited to, I want to say about, and I'm being kind of generous, maybe 15. If that, there's not a lot of locations, but the amount of impact that happens in each of these scenes and how it's all, it's paced and just the direction is just so good. Yeah. There's an unbelievable amount of control. I think I read somewhere that like Todd Field said, I think the only really restriction that it has like to make it the runtime at least somewhat reasonable in quotes, because this movie's over 2.5 hours. So he couldn't make like a 4 hour long, like, Irishman type movie. But still, this is a movie that, in my opinion, I give the sense that there was no interference from the studios. It's something that he wanted to make, and there were no exceptions, pretty much. And that's really awesome to see, just because we need more movies like this. Mm-hmm. We need more movies that showcase artist talent on like basically unaltered.
Yeah, and I think this, like, again, like you're talking about, we need movies like this. I think it comes out at an important time where we're doing a lot of biopics and stuff like that. And I think that goes again into the conversation about like, is Lydia Tár real or not? Because people expect movies about real people and expect movies that are like about the accomplishments and the rise and fall of like pop stars and celebrities. And I think like that people, we've lost character pieces, and having this movie that is like a real person that is so close to something that's tangible, and seeing that, like, we're not used to it anymore, which is kind of like weird and eerie, you know what I mean? And I think it shows like how powerful these pieces are and why they should be, you know what I mean, big, and why we should continue to make characters feel like humans, that we can, like, we could literally see Lydia Tár playing a concert. We could watch her TED Talk, you know what I mean? We could like listen to her on Spotify because like she is almost like reality.
And also like the dialogue and the way Field handles like these real world technology, real world conversations, that only adds to the realism of this film and how Lydia Tár could easily be confused for being a real life individual. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how in I think later this month or either next month, there's another film, it's called She Said, which is about like the Me Too movement. That seems like it's going to divulge more into like the investigative journalism part, which Tár isn't really, there are definitely elements from that movement, even though it is a fictional story. And I'm curious to see how that will compare, where we have this real life story about these allegations and about like about these individuals, whereas this one is more not parody, that's not the word I'm looking for, it's definitely not that, but more of a reinterpretation mm-hmm. of real life events, of real life people that could easily be seen.
Yes, and I think it also questions like the different like gender politics within the like the discussion, because it's asking like and demanding that we recognize that like this can happen to anyone, and mm-hmm. anyone could be an abuser, anyone could be a victim. You know what I mean? And I think that has strength in that, because I think there's been a lot of discussion again about Lydia Tarr and her role as a woman in this, all of this. And it's saying like, this can happen, you know what I mean? Like, because this person's in such a great role of like power and power plays, and she's lost herself. So I think it shows, I don't know. I think it's really truly like, it's so much about humanity and about like where we are and within relation to what's happening right now. I also found it interesting that it kind of like name dropped the pandemic in there. And it was about like, oh, like she was like, oh, I think it was during the conducting scene. She said like, we haven't been back in 2 years, which I think is interesting because we've been talking a lot about what post-pandemic art will look like. And it's fascinating that this is kind of like one of the first big ones that has come out.
It isn't like about pandemics. Like, mm-hmm. There's no one really, as far as I'm aware, nobody wears a mask either. Like there's no mention of mm-hmm. any of like the things. Cause I can think of like Drive My Car, for example, like the ending of that takes place during the pandemic but that one's more just seems like, oh, it's because of like the time that it was written. But this one actually has kind of a emphasis on it in terms of how art has changed, how people's lives have changed, and also the interactions that we have too. That is completely.
Yeah.
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 Well, we're going to transition to a quick PSA and we'll be right back with more Bijou Banter. Welcome back to Bijou Banter. We are continuing our conversation on Tarr. And with all this talk about Tarr, let's talk about Cate Blanchett or the performances. All of them. Fantastic performances, especially in the lead role. Todd Field said that if he not only wrote the part of Tarr with Cate Blanchett in mind, but if she said no, he wouldn't have made the film, which yeah. is crazy.
Dedication. Yeah. I also think Nina Haas was really great.
Yeah.
And there was an interview which she said like that her character was no innocent housewife, which I found very fascinating because, again, with like the content of the film, I think like her role as her wife and also as her first violinist, who usually like starts the orchestra. It was very interesting to like talk about the relations we have with people and like the way we have to either condemn or, you mean, support them in these moments.
Yeah, and even with the role that Noémie Merlant's character has, she plays Tarr's assistant, and how she's pretty much at the hands of Tarr. It's like she really can't disagree with anything that she says, and puts her in such an uncomfortable position where, like, in a turning point towards the beginning of the third act that ultimately changes the direction of everything.
Yeah.
The entire movie, her career, her relationship, it's all at the hands of this one individual, ironically enough, who feels like she doesn't have much control because of Tarr.
Yeah, it was a beautiful, beautiful cast. Like, all of them were so electric. And I think it was really cool for her, too, as, like, coming off of Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Mm-hmm. In my head, I just saw her in that role, you know what I mean? But, like, I think immediately she made me so interested in her. And I think it was a very great showing. Like, I'm so glad she's breaking into like more of a global industry, so we can kind of see her more, because she's fantastic.
Yeah, and I remember when I saw Portrait of Lady on Fire, I was thinking like I would really love to see either her or the I'm blanking on the other actress's name.
Not sure either.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I think she retired from acting. Apparently, she wasn't really happy with the industry. But I remember thinking like I would love to see them break out into like, not specifically American films, just as like other films in general, just because we haven't really seen much of them on an international level. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad she was able to play a part in this movie. And do you think that this movie could go for Academy Awards recognition just because we're now heading into that season?
I think it will. Obviously, Cate Blanchett is like without a doubt one of them. Sound mixing.
Oh, the sound incredible. Mixing. Yeah.
Best picture, directing. I'm not sure because obviously we haven't seen everything yet. If I fully feel like it is the best picture of the year. In my head, I'm kind of, when I sit on it, there's more things that I kind of wish were pulled out of it. Because I think because it was so character driven, a lot of the aspects of it kind of got like pulled to the side. Like I mentioned the surrealist element of it earlier, like the guilt and like that. Whenever she saw like the girl that her ex student, like in the rooms with her and stuff like that. So I think it's a very good movie, and it's definitely a movie that should be seen if you so wish to. But I don't know if I'd want it to win like Best Picture. I'm not sure yet.
I don't know if this has a shot at winning Best Picture. If anything, I remember when I was watching it, I was thinking like this is something that the Academy could so easily ignore because the subject matter hits a little too home with that with like higher ups in the industry and stuff.
Oh my God, yes.
However, I've been looking at a lot of award predictions like from sources like IndieWire, Variety, and et cetera, and Tarr is consistently like one of the top contenders. So. Mm. at this rate, I would not be surprised at all if it does get a Best Picture nomination. Cate Blanchett honestly might take Best Actress at this rate. Unfortunately, Ana de Armas, I don't think, is in the running because nobody liked Blonde except us. So, but on a technical level, too, it's just, it's incredible. Like, there's there's in the Juilliard sequence, that whole scene, it's probably like 15 minutes, if not longer, one long uninterrupted take. And it's beautiful. Yeah.
Oh, and especially that first TED Talk, too. I mean, the way the camera moves and you kind of constantly see that back of the head of the ex-student and you don't know why they're showing you that specific shot. It's just, all of it is thought out so well and it's paced so well. Like, I know we keep mentioning it, 2 hours and 30 minutes, but like, sometimes, you know, you can feel it. Like, but
near the end, it dragged a little bit if I had any complaints about the pacing. And also, going back to the opening scene with the TED Talk, what a wonderful way to like deliver exposition to not only us as the audience, but also for the people within the film. It doesn't feel out of place because this is like, the opening scene, she has like a panel discussion with someone from The New Yorker. And he's going through like all her accomplishments. Like, she graduated from the school. She's won the X amount of awards, has conducted how many, whatever orchestras.
Yeah.
And that's all stuff that we need to know as an audience member because this is not a real person. But within the film, the audience that's watching it also needs to know that.
Yeah.
And it's not distracting at all.
And it places us so well in like modern times too. Like, it does so good for world building because the minute you hear that TED Talk, you know exactly when it is. You know exactly who the type of person this is. It's someone that's supposed to be like trailblazing, who is, you know what I mean, like being lifted up for all these different things she's done. But then you kind of find out about all the stuff behind closed doors. So it's very, again, like it's very real for people in the art world, people in the world in general, you know what I mean? Celebrities.
Yeah.
Like, it's a very, very smart way to make us see her and understand her and understand this world.
Like, even with her, with the accusations that has brought up upon her with like, I don't think this is really a spoiler, but it's like, it's not just the article, but the video, the way that was handled. That's very much something that happens all the time on Twitter. And that's one of the reasons why I don't know if hit home is the right way, but it's like, wow, this feels so genuine.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably why I know when we, by complete coincidence, we happened to be at the same screening and we were the youngest ones there. And I think probably why a lot of, maybe some reasons why, I don't think older audiences are necessarily disliking this movie, but perhaps why they might be confused or laughing is just because they're, for lack of better words, kind of out of touch with how, like, with social media, or they're not nearly on it as much as someone, as like college students are, for example. So if, oddly enough, I don't think younger people would necessarily go out to see this movie, but if you're able to, if you would like to, it's very much just like, wow, this feels so genuine and real.
And I think what you said, like with older audiences, I think the thing is too, is that for a lot of older people, not all, there's kind of this like looking down on our generation for caring about identity or for caring about, like, you mean like the past and the present of like artists that we're looking up to. And people will put it off so often and like laugh at it and act like we're sensitive. So I think a lot of times when people hear her, they almost in a way relate to her because they also have maybe done this or think this about people our age. And I think it's an interesting like division that happens. And then what I appreciate about this movie is that it didn't just make a movie laughing at younger people for caring about, like, I don't like in quotations, like this idea of cancel culture or whatever, but like it rather analyzed it and came at it from both angles, questioning like what it means and asking us all to like approach it and saying like, okay, like you may come from this from a specific side, but like realize why it's important. And not only that, but realize what can be lost and what can be gained, you know? So yeah. I appreciated that.
Yeah, it doesn't villainize one group of people or like one, like, I probably shouldn't go down more, but it's like, it doesn't villainize one specific group. And really, it's like, this could happen to anybody. And that's what's so important, that I think a lot of people who are engaging the discourse, for lack of better words, fail to understand. It's like, it's not saying that like every single person, like TAR means it's just like, that's the only one. Or it's like, no, it's like this is anyone, this can happen with anyone.
Yeah. And I think like, as someone who is like a queer woman, I think, you know, having representation that's only good does not equal representation. So I appreciate that this movie is willing to have a character that is supposed to be a lesbian woman who is a part of this, not saying that I agree with her again, but I'm saying like having characters that are not great people, it can like you said, it can happen to anyone. And I appreciate that representation, quite honestly, because I think it's important that we have characters that are nuanced, that we don't just have good representation, you know?
Yeah, and that's fascinating just in general, just for the longevity and also evolution of these of films about people in the LGBTQ plus community, just because then it adds something new to the discussion.
Yeah.
Not to say that it's like checking off boxes, be like, oh, we got to be different. Okay, let's do this. But it's like, no, it's actually a good story. It's a very fascinating character piece. And it's opening eyes to like in different directions where it's like, oh, I didn't think about that in this way.
Yeah.
So
I saw a tweet saying that this was our Daniel Plainview, which I was like, oh, yes, it is.
Oh, there's a lot of similarities to There Will Be Blood.
Yeah, and I think it's really neat. Like, I mean, it's such an interesting thing to be able to dissect and study because, I don't know, I think Kate Blanchett, she's obviously been in Carol, she's been in this, and I appreciate seeing actors being willing to be a part of this and, like, you mean, kind of tell queer stories. I think it's just, it's a great direction, you know what I mean? Being able to say, like, we can have these characters who are nuanced, who may be, like, the most sinister people we could ever imagine, you know what I mean? Because I think it gets closer to, again, making human characters.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's one of those films where I've read some reviews, like most for this movie's been getting very high critical reception, but I've read some reviews that like they have some very interesting claims where they deem it's like not, I don't know if misogynistic is the right word, but borderline like offensive, I guess. Like, I don't know if it's like a race thing or not, but there's very interesting claim or critiques of this film.
Yeah, I think seeing it, I don't think it's misogynistic. Again, I think this goes back to not every representation has to be like good. And I actually saw a review from a critic, a film critic. I forget what magazine she writes for.
Was it Amy Talbin?
I think it might have been, because she said like it should have been a movie about her fighting misogyny in the music industry, and it should have been about her like rising to fame. And it's like, again, that's like a biopic. We've seen that, and also, not everything has to be happy. And I think we're seeing this movie coming out again post-pandemic, a lot of like Disney Plus Marvel content, you know what I mean? Like stuff that audiences are usually used to is like these happy endings. And I think this movie is for a lot of people like pushing against that, you know what I mean? And it's not comfortable for a lot of people to have to question that. I know I don't speak for all women, but I don't see it misogynistic. I'm just glad that again, like as I said with like queer representation, I'm glad we're getting like a full nuanced take saying that this can be anyone, that like a woman is capable of this, a woman in power is capable of this, and also that like, yeah, just that they're not like holding back, that any character can be like this and we're not like shying away from it.
Yeah, so we are just about out of time for our conversation on Tar, so final thoughts?
Yeah, I would definitely say if you'd like to, go see it. It's very, very interesting, very fascinating. As an ex-musician, it definitely scarred me because I know many conductors like this, not to the same extremes, but just very like strict. But I would say it's very beautiful in the way that it handles its situations and that it is just very fantastic. Great acting, great directing, all of it. So definitely check it out if you can.
Yeah, so I really, really liked it as well. And I will say, honestly, I don't know if it's one of those films where it's say you would either love it or hate it, but you might have different perspectives, but at the same time, it is really refreshing to see something different like this. And it is kind of like in a way a biopic about a person that really doesn't exist. Like we get this life story and how it's this like rise, not even a rise, just a start at the top and then kind of like a descent downwards. But also, how does studying how one is trying to retain that fame? And I thought it was really, really fascinating. I really love a good character piece. So yeah. Highly recommend checking it out. It's still playing at Film Scene at the Ped Mall. I originally said the Chauncey. It's actually the Ped Mall. So apologies. And I really, really liked Tar. It's probably one of my favorite films of this year so far. And I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10.
I'll give it an 8.5.
Nice. 8.5. So we're going to move on from Tar to another film called Wendell and Wild. And Wendell and Wild is the latest film from director Henry Selick. And it's the latest film from director Henry Selick. It was who also did Nightmare Before Christmas and Coraline, and it stars Keegan-Michael Key, Jordan Peele, Angela Bassett, Lyric Ross, and Ving Rhames. And the plot of this movie, from IMDb, it's about two scheming demon brothers named Wendell and Wild who enlist the aid of a 13-year-old girl named Kat Elliott to summon them to the land of the living. Now, we will, Davey Beam, if you are listening to this right now, please enter the Care UI studio if you're coming. But yeah, basically, until he comes in, oh, look who it is. if you want to come into the so Wendell Wild, I guess I'll just give my thoughts on it real quick. I really, really love Henry Selick. I think he is a wonderful filmmaker. Nightmare Before Christmas and Coraline are two of the best stop motion films of our time. And before I continue on, would you like to say hi, Davey?
Hi, I'm Davey.
Yeah, so I guess here, what did you think of Wendell and Wild? I'm sorry we're all over the place.
I really loved it. It's really hard to be mad at stop motion because it's just like it takes forever to make. And so it's just like so beautiful and so creative. And like I know that like some of the story beats may have not flowed particularly well with some people, but I don't think a movie has to necessarily have a spectacle every 5 minutes or every 10 minutes or so, but it was really beautiful. And it's hard to not enjoy it.
Yeah, as I was saying, I really, really love Henry Selick. Nightmare Before Christmas and Coraline are incredible films. So I was really looking forward to this one. This has been in development for a little while. It was announced a while back, and I don't know if it got delayed or not, but it took a while for this movie to come out. And hearing that the last film Henry Selick did was Coraline, which came out in 2009, and I was like, okay, he's going to come back. Who knows how it's going to be, but, you know, I know the animation is going to be great. Don't really know much of the story. And I think for the most part, it's entertaining. It's not terrible. And, like, the animation, amazing, as usual. What I really like about the animation, too, and we could get into this later, is the techniques that they use to make it more stop motion-like. It's not entirely smooth, like, intentionally so. It's not that it looks bad, but it feels, like, a bit rougher because stop motion is such a hands-on physical thing that you have to do. And it's really nice to see like the fingerprints and also a little bit of imperfections within the animation. However, the biggest problem with this movie that I found is that I don't think the story and the characters were that great. Nightmare Before Christmas is not a groundbreaking story either, but first of all, it's a lot shorter. And I think the thing with Wendell and Wild is that it tries to be a little bit bigger of a story than it needs to be. It seems like they're trying to go really all in on being like really dark and creepy and weird. So, and in the end, I would have been fine had the characters been a bit more interesting. I wasn't really big on a lot of them. And what I found kind of weird about this movie too is that it's somehow rated PG-13. And I'm not saying it had to be like bloody or gory, but Coraline is a pretty, really pushes the envelope for like scary imagery in like what is was supposedly a family film. And Wendell Wild is definitely tamer than that. But and even the story too, it's a very simple story that is very much appropriate for families, but it has that PG-13 rating attached to it. So I'm a little confused for that reason. I wouldn't say that it's a awful film, but it was definitely a disappointing one for me.
I actually didn't know that it was PG-13.
Oh, really?
I thought it was PG. Yeah.
Yeah. It does, I don't understand why, because they say hell a lot, but that you can say hell in PG movies. So yeah. I don't really understand why. And it's not like there are some, I guess, violent parts, but it's like with the supernatural, like they're already dead to begin with, so maybe it just gets too macabre or not. But I genuinely don't understand why it's rated PG-13, especially because we're in an age where we've talked about this before on past episodes of Banter. Like the way with the internet and stuff, you can look up pretty much anything. There's very much free access to most content now that like the MPAA rating system is just kind of, I wouldn't say irrelevant, but just it needs a massive restructuring because it's dated. I don't understand why this got that rating. It really doesn't make any sense to me.
I will agree. Like now that I know that information, that doesn't make any sense to me. I think I feel like that discourages families from watching it, and I don't think it needs to be restricted. I mean, yeah, I really don't see how like I feel like that just really takes away from saying that it's a family film, and it's a family film.
Yeah,
it's about family.
It is. Yeah, it's definitely it's a family film, and there's a lot of elements that are very much crowd pleasing. What I don't understand about it is that it seems like what happened, and I don't know much about the production of this film. My guess is that they probably wanted to be a little more mature in terms of what they could show, but Netflix maybe was like, you gotta tone it down a bit. So they toned it down, and the story too, like especially with the morals and stuff, it feels very dumbed down, even for a family film. Like it's so direct, and like I'm not saying every family film needs to be like really deep or philosophical, but mm-hmm. I think people, especially producers, undermine the fact that children are actually a lot smarter than they think. Like look at Marcel the Show with Shoes On, for example. Like that's a very poignant, moving film that actually makes children think. It doesn't spell out everything, but it's addressed in a way where they can understand it. And also adults will appreciate that too, just because it's just a moving story to begin with. It seems like in Wendell and Wild, they just dumbed it down so much, but they still got the PG rating. And that's what I genuinely don't understand. And Marcel, the Show with Shoes On is rated PG. And I think that's a little more mature than this.
Yeah, I will agree. I will agree. And I to your point about like the characters or like it feels too grandiose. I actually felt like it wasn't as grandiose as Coraline. I felt
you
like there's
so?
A lot of parts where it was just Kat like going and doing school stuff, and I don't know, like I mean I'm like I don't know. I felt like it was kind of more about the school and how like they like translated or fit in to that world.
Yeah, it seems like they wanted to do two stories with Wendell and Wild. You have like this, obviously the Land of the Living, where Kat is she goes to like this all-girls school because she feels this incredible amount of guilt for the death of her parents. And that's not a spoiler because it's literally the first scene of the movie. So so there's that, and then she's trying to fit in and like trying to, and she discovers like this, like there's these secrets, and how in the world of the dead, I guess, you have these two demon brothers who want to escape, like not like want a ticket out of that to like go back to the Land of the Living. And then she makes a deal with them to be like, hey, if I could bring you back, but you gotta bring back my parents. And that's kind of, it transitions into a completely different story in my eyes, and it doesn't really have a lot, it doesn't blend together too well. And that's fine if you want to do something segmented, but it felt way too like out of place at times where they just kept transitioning back. It felt like two different movies.
I will say I think Coraline really did had a better pacing, but I mean I feel like I don't think that was supposed to be. Like, I don't know. I feel like it was trying to do something differently, and maybe it didn't execute it as well as Coraline did, but I don't think it was trying to be pretty segmented on purpose and intentional. I mean, especially like if it took a long time, I feel like there would have had to be a lot of thought in how this movie was going to be presented. So I feel like And even though like Harry Selick has been out of the game for a little bit, I feel like at least story beats should be something that he would know already. So I feel like it was intentional whether it was as executed as well as he wanted it to be. Might be a different thing entirely, but I respect that.
I think I do have an answer for you, because Wendell and Wild was in fact co-written by Henry Selick. He co-wrote it with Jordan mm-hmm. Peele
yes.
as well, and Wendell and Wild was based on an unpublished story by Henry Selick as well. Coraline was based on a novella, I think, and it wasn't written by Selick. So I think as far as my knowledge, I don't think Henry Selick had any writing credits on Nightmare Before Christmas. I think that was all Burton's idea. So as far as I'm aware, this is Henry Selick's first time having active involvement in the writing itself. And I think that's probably where the problem lies. Because if he hasn't really had much experience in writing feature films, then that's why it feels a little more sophomoric in some way with the characters and with kind of like the narrative itself. The narrative is just a little clunky. Because even though Coraline is a very simple story, and you could argue, I could see arguments being like, oh, it's like it is kind of segmented, just like she keeps going back from like her own world to this to like weird dream world too. At least what I like is that you focus on her, Coraline herself. There's not this like bound, like imperfect balance between like these two characters. And it just seems like they're trying to juggle a little too much with who we were supposed to follow. Because the title is called Wendell and Wild, and I would argue that they're not even the main focus of the movie. It's more about Kat.
Yes.
Which is a little weird, because if it was focused on the two demon brothers, I actually think that would have been a bit more of an interesting movie. It could have been a bit more like edgy, I guess, and more adult, just because with Kat's character and with the situation she's in, we've seen that before in like other films where she's has this traumatic incident and is basically like sheltered from the rest of the world. She's pretty much a loner in a way and doesn't really want to associate with anyone. But then it's like within these circumstances, that's what rekindles her spirits. That's a very common trope. Not saying that you can't use tropes in movies, but it's just very formulaic. And for that reason, it didn't really do a great job of keeping my attention within the narrative. Visually, that's another story, and we can get into that. But, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Because I think when I, like, first heard about Wendell and Wild, I was thinking it was going to be more about Key and Peele.
You would think, because they're like the face of the title, and also they're heavily advertising their involvement in them, and they're great as usual.
They're really good, and that's why I was just confused that like, okay, so they're like the advertisements and everything was like they're the two main characters, and in fact like how I was like telling people about the movie. Was that it stars Key and Peele. And then when I watched it, I was just like, oh, it does. I mean, it doesn't really star them, but they're in it. So it was like misleading. But I guess like they did that in Scream, right? Like they sort of,
which Scream, the new one?
The first one with Barrymore.
I'll be honest, I've never seen Scream. So
me either.
I've seen the opening scene and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, me either. What I hear is that like Drew Barrymore was advertised as the main character, and then something happened, and then she wasn't able to really do that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Wendell and Wild is that I think the only reason why is because Key and Peele are basically the most recognizable names in terms of the actors. Not to say that everyone else like isn't, but they're. Like, especially Jordan Peele with his work on Nope, Get Out, and Us. Yeah. He's, like, one of the go-to horror directors. And Keegan Michael Key has been in a lot of movies as of recently. So their names are so recognizable. It's like, of course you want to advertise that. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a bait and switch, though, because I think of what Hitchcock did with Psycho. Like, it was promoted that, like, Janet Leigh, it seemed like she was going to be the protagonist. But then, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Psycho, she's killed off by Norman Bates in the shower. And that's like such a great bait and switch because like, oh, it plays with your expectations. And also I think back then there probably really wasn't anything like that, but we've had so many in like, what is it? How long has it been since Psycho? Like 60 years almost, or over 60 years at this point. There's been so many other people trying to replicate that it's not really anything new. And I don't think Wendell Wild was trying to subvert expectations. It was more just, hey, these are the most recognizable stars in this movie. Let's make them the focus. And I wouldn't be so concerned about if the main character was at least a little more interesting. So, but before we continue on, we're going to transition into a quick grand spot and we'll be right back with more Bijou Banter. Welcome back to Bijou Banter. We are continuing our conversation on Wendell and Wild. And what did you think about the stop motion animation in this film?
It was gorgeous as ever. I did like the fact that it was a very... It was very different from Coraline and Nightmare Before Christmas, and even James and the Giant Peach.
Oh yeah, he did do that one.
Yeah, I keep forgetting about that one.
It's a weird movie, by the way.
I mean, it was it's definitely like I think I liked it okay as a kid, but it wasn't. It was definitely like Coraline is definitely the one that.
I think really shines. But I think the animate, but what I like about this one is it just felt like it was different. Cause I was thinking, oh, it's just gonna be more of the same sort of style as Coraline. And it wasn't. It was very more, it was probably even more cartoony and visually pleasing than I feel Coraline was. It just really like it really shined in that department, whether or not the story works as well. I don't know. Sorry.
That's okay.
This movie really looks visually pleasing and probably more so than Coraline. But yeah, that's kind of how I've had it.
It's definitely going for different vibes than Coraline, because Coraline, mm-hmm. when I think of that movie, it's such a visually creative and stunning movie, but it's also incredibly sinister and dark and creepy, mm-hmm. too. Wendell Wild has some creepy elements, but in a more cartoony way. And not to say that that's a bad thing, because it is it's a very colorful, it's very bright, and it's very eye-catching, too. And I especially love the contrast between, like, the school that Kat goes to and how it's so, like, dreary and depressing, just like there's like no life or heart into it. Whereas when you go to like the Land of the Living or any scene with Wendell Wild, there's so much life and color into it. And I mentioned this earlier, but Henry Selick has said in interviews before this movie came out that he believed that stop motion got to the point where it was so good that it was indistinguishable from regular hand-drawn or CG animation. So he intentionally like let some of the replacement faces, like the line molds, like stick out a bit more so that you can tell that stop motion. Also, the frames weren't like super smooth. It was all intentional. Mm-hmm. And people say like, oh, was he trying to make the movie look bad? It's like, no, he's not trying to make the movie look bad. It's just because that's the art style. Like the art style stop motion animation isn't meant to be super smooth, but technology has gotten to the point where you can fix all that. It's kind of like when people go back to like hand-drawn animated films and add it, like digitally add 60 frames per second. It's just like you're ruining the art style and the look of that. And I'm not saying that that's what newer stop motion animated films do, but I like it when it's a little archaic, when it's a little like stiff looking, just because you can tell that's like the puppeteers are actually moving the figures. And that's really refreshing to see. And I'm really glad he made that choice, just because it sticks out more from other stop motion films.
Yeah. and I think that like there's some like movies that I think it was Into the Spider-Verse, where I was like, is this is stop motion, right? Because it had like they changed the like how it was animated, which gave it a unique feel. And then to like be like, oh, actually, no, this is animated. Like, it's not stop motion. It's just animated, and they chose that for a practical reason, of course. But it really worked for the style, and to see like that sort of animation and the imperfections of it. I think it is very eye catching, and it really goes along with the beauty of what animation can be like. I get that, like, we want to try to see how far we can go with technology to see, like how realistic we can make animation, and you know, which I feel like the Lion King, remake is like trying to be like, oh, look at this, like realistic animation. So it's just crazy that there's like. Well, it's not great, but it's very nice to see the other side trying to be very like, hey, this is animation, like, and here's the imperfections of it. And I think that's really good, because like it really stands out from just like big production studios making like really big budgeted movies, but don't feel like there's a lot of heart in it, because it feels way too
too
cleaned up.
Yeah, because I remember like the only other stop motion anime film that I can think of recently that kind of wasn't afraid to show the imperfections was Isle of Dogs by Wes Anderson, just because the way the fur moves in that too, you could tell it's like just because the hands were like moving it around and stuff. And like when clean stop motion animation is just as nice too, but it looks a little too clean. And that's, I guess, what we're trying to allude to.
Yeah.
But yeah, and like there's some really impressive, like in general, like what Henry Selick has done very well is just how much he's able to do with like the scale of the stop motion animation, just the amount of stuff that is animated. Like the, as kind of cheesy that I think the climax of the movie is, there's a lot of action going on with all the puppets and stuff. It's like there's a lot that you have to like work with. Or even when we're introduced to the Land of the Dead near the beginning with like that, almost like that roller coaster type thing. It's just like, it's so elaborate and creative. Like how do they think of this stuff and how they manage to pull it off so flawlessly? And you know that that basically took like 5 years probably to animate. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got anything else to add?
I don't know. I think maybe going back into like the story, part, I wanted to say that, like, you, like, even though this was Harry Selick's first writing credit, he
did have
help. At
least I'm pretty sure. Let me double check real quick. He was a writer on Coraline, but that was based on a novel.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a pre-existing property.
Okay.
So yeah, Wendell and Wild, it was based on an unpublished story, but he was the author of that story. So it's his idea. So.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say, cause like they, like he had help with Jordan Peele.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like even if it was like a little bit new, for him, I would think that like the story wouldn't have been affected, because, you know, Jordan has been writing, you know, has done three movies and has all written all of his movies, right?
Yeah, he's written all the movies he's directed, and also he's had, I'm pretty sure he's had, he co-wrote the Candyman movie from last year, which...
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a great script, unfortunately, but he's had other writing credits, so...
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think the point I'm trying to make is that, like, I think that, I feel like... I feel like I would still lean into it was intentionally told this way. And again, I think that I could get why people wouldn't like think it was executed in the best way, but I don't know. I think I really enjoyed my time and it was really interesting. And I think, but that could have just been, I was just so enamored with the animation that I wasn't really thinking about the story as much as as maybe I should have been, but I don't know, it was just really cool to look at. It's just a really fun film. So
would you say those are your final thoughts, or do you have anything else to add for your final thoughts?
Oh boy, that's a lot of pressure.
No, it's okay. If you were to recommend this movie to other people, how would you like describe the movie then? What's like your pitch?
Okay, my pitch would be stop motion animation that stars Key and Peele, directed by the legendary Harry Selick, and this is his first movie, and I think you said in your letterbox
13
years?
12 or 13, one of those.
12 or 13 years. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, even though I'm a film student, like, that would get me to... I would think that would be a good pitch.
Yeah.
Recommending it to my family, they're not really film people, so it's it's a little different, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, just to give my final thoughts, I was looking forward to this movie, and I would honestly call it a bit of a disappointment. Not that it's a bad movie. I think there's really good things about it. Even after a 13-year absence, Henry Selick has still proven himself to be one of the greatest stop-motion directors of our time. honestly, but I just wish the story was at least a little more, just a little more focused. Maybe if the characters were a bit more interesting, and also if they really wanted to go all in and make it like really dark and disturbing, but also like darkly comedic too, this could have been something really, really cool. But unfortunately, they went down the more safe route, which is understandable just because it's like, it's meant to be crowd pleasing despite the rating. Like, it, I still don't, I do not understand for the life of me why this got PG-13. But anyway, Wendell and Wild, it's entertaining, and I'm glad I saw it. I just don't know if I'll see it again for a while. It's currently streaming on Netflix. Check it out if you would like to. I'm going to give it a 6 out of 10. I think that's fair. If you were to rate it, what would you rate it?
10 out of 10.
Wow. That's a positive review from Davey for Wendell and Wild. And that concludes this episode of BG Banter. Tune in next week, where we're going to talk about Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, and potentially something else. I'm not really sure. But until next time, I've been Matthew.
And I've been Davey.
We will see you all next time. Bye-bye.